שלום, 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 ברוכים הבאים. Welcome to Awakening, Torah, Musar, Mindfulness. I'm Rabbi Chasya Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. I'm delighted to be here with you today. This is Motzei Shabbat in Israel. It's Saturday, November 18th. It has been well over a week, maybe even 2 weeks since I've met with you to learn and practice together. I was sick this past week from all the stress of our hostages, our people being kidnapped and held as captives in Gaza, and the stress, just even though I practiced and worked on myself, the stress just began to tear away at my immune system. So I'm not alone. I'm trying to take care of myself, right? Practice that stress management, eat well, take care of ourselves. So I'm showing up today first to cover last week's Torah portion, right? Which was Chaye Sara. It really took place on Shabbat on November 11th, which was Kaf Zayin of Cheshvan of Tafshin Pei Daled, the Hebrew month of Cheshvan, the 27th, and the Hebrew year of 5784. So that obviously was November 11th, 2023. So we're going to cover Chaye Sara, and then either later in Moshe Shabbat or tomorrow, we will jump into Toledot. No worries, it's going to get done, B'zrat Hashem, God willing. So I'm delighted you're here. Let's begin with our kavanot, our intentions for today's session, as we always do. So you will see before you that we see this time together as a threefold practice. And it's between the self, others, and God, our relationship with the divine. So we see this time together of doing awakening Torah, Musar, mindfulness to engage in an act of radical self-care, to actually learn and practice. As you know, this whole year is being dedicated to our grief and loss from the genocide of October 7th in Israel, and how we are going to either recover, or for those of us who can't recover, to cope with the new reality, to cope with what is real, seeing clearly, as we are directed to do in the Dharma practice. So we are doing this act of radical self-care. We say they're doing this to strengthen our own soul in order to be of benefit to others in the future. So right now, we really need to care for ourselves, and all these kind of practices and acts on a daily basis to work on healing. And so that allows us to be able to reach out, right? And care for others. And a big part of the secret of the survival of the Jewish people, especially here in Israel in general, of all citizens, is how much we turn to care for one another. And that is really strengthening our own souls and strengthening each other. So we say we're also doing this as an act for others, strengthen our relationship to others, so we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. We're also doing this to strengthen our relationship with the divine so that we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. This is all about this beautiful relationship of caring. So I'm going to stop sharing for those of you who had vision and were watching by video. For those of you listening on audio, I'm stopping sharing screen of what I just read out loud to you. So we're going to jump into a summary of Chaye Sara. And then I'm going to jump in with our theme of grief and loss and what we can learn from this Torah portion, okay? What God and our ancestors wanted us to get out of this. So in Chaye Sara, Sara, our ancestor, our first matriarch, is 127 years old when she dies. And the interesting thing is, why is this Torah portion called Chaye Sara, the life or lives of Sarah, right? Well, it's all about what led up to her life and what is necessary to come after her death in order to continue her life, and the that her life be a blessing, essentially, that her memory be for a blessing. And so, you might have called it the death of Sarah, but it's really about the legacy of what she planted and what gets passed on. So Abraham cries for her husband, our first patriarch, and he buys the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, which is the cave of Machpelah, as a burial place for her in modern day Hebron. He buys it from Ephron for 400 shekels of silver. Abraham sends his servant on a mission to find a wife for Yitzhak, his son, from Abraham's birthplace. So Abraham's servant asks God for a sign in choosing the right wife, the right life partner for Yitzhak. And he says if the woman offers to give him water to him and his cattle, camels, then he will know that she's the one. What's amazing about this, it makes you think, well, was this kind of searching for qualifications for a wife done for Avram? Or was he just given his half-sister? what sort of intention and kavanah was there? Or did they have to essentially grow and learn together and figure out each other's strengths and how they could really be a people and the foundation for a people later on. So it continues that Rivka arrives at the well, okay, which is happens to be the daughter of Lavan, who no, not the daughter, the sister of Lavan, who is essentially, the servant is being sent to look for a wife for Yitzhak. He ends up, Yitzhak ends up marrying Rivka, which is known as Rebecca in English, okay, and Isaac. So she quickly brings water to the servant and to his camels. Rivka invites Abraham's servant to her home. He meets her father, Betuel, and her brother, Lavan. Abraham's servant tells the whole story to Rivka's family. And everyone says Rivka is to go, if she wants to go and marry Yitzhak. And she says yes. And Rivka's family gives a blessing. She returns with Abraham's servant and she marries Yitzhak. Abraham, in the closing of this Torah portion, is 175 years old when he dies. And together, his sons, Yitzhak and Yishmael, bury Abraham next to Sarah in the Me'arat HaMachpelah. And finally, Yishmael, at the end, we are told, dies at 137 years old. Okay, so that is a summary of our Torah portion. So, in given our theme of covering grief and loss, and how we might learn from the Torah portion and practice, really bring these ancient traditions and perspectives of Musar in the Jewish tradition, and mindfulness and Theravada Buddhism and the Dharma, to really get the most out of the Torah portion, but also learn what is it that God wants from us, what is it that our ancestors want to teach us and learn. So we're looking at grief and loss, and in particular, we're looking at how our ancestors, how they responded to kind of grief and loss and trauma around them. How did they resource? How did they pivot? How did they either respond or react? Really important lessons in seeing, did they recover or was it coping? And how we might really turn to this as something that can be not only a resource, but a real balm, something that we turn to weekly, as we do as Jews, to read the Torah portion, that we look forward to because we know there'll be something there to carry us and comfort us. Okay. So I'm drawing on the teachings of some of the world's experts on grief and loss and on trauma and how what's to be expected in response to it and how we can respond in the best ways, and work towards healing, for some people recovery, for some people coping. So in particular, I'm turning on turning towards the work of Rick Hansen, who teaches on grief and loss. And in particular, when looking at something like a genocide, as took place on October 7th in Israel, something that was not happening in a vacuum, something that happened to us as a people that come from thousands and thousands of years of other peoples attacking us, killing us, kidnapping us, forcing us into conversion or death, raping, torturing, winning on for 2,500 years, whether it was, you know, Assyria, Babylonia, or whether it was Greeks or the Romans, or the different peoples and nations of Europe. This is something that is part of our people's ongoing communal trauma, transgenerational trauma, and also resilience, because obviously we're here and we survive. So the first thing that they teach is to see the whole, to attempt to see the whole. And it's been now over 40 days. God, it just hits me to say it, right? It hits me to say it because we still have hostages, captives in Gaza. And it just hits me. It's been over 40 days since this genocide, and we've been at war in Palestinian Gaza, going after those who are responsible. And for us, we're now at a place over 40 days where some of us are ready to begin to breathe and pivot and resource a bit more. For those who are directly impacted, meaning they've actually lost someone, were injured themselves, were raped and survived, who obviously are kidnapped and can't even have access to joining us. Those who maybe even were surviving a trauma beforehand, and then this happens, right? Whatever it might be, we're all in different places. And then there are those of us like concentric circles who are moving away from the direct experience of what happened, the epicenter. Some of us on the outside, even leading to the diaspora of Jews feeling very fearful, fighting their own war of anti-Jewish, anti-Semitism. Some of us are ready to begin to look at how we can resource and begin moving through this with it. So the first is to, we are taught to begin to see the whole. That we can, in the middle of a trauma, we can become over-focused, over-identified with really stimulus bounds, right? And so to begin to be able to have that long lens, right? To pull back and see the whole. That's the first thing that we begin to resource. And what we're going to notice in this Torah portion is Avraham Avinu, our ancestor and first patriarch Avraham, does something like that. When he is heading towards death, there is a pulling back and seeing the whole. And even in Chaye Sarah, even with Yitzhak, as he begins to move towards Toledot, you will see a similar thing where there's this beginning to see the whole, the larger picture of one's life and purpose and outside of themselves, belonging to their am, their people, and so forth. The second is this thing called empathetic imagination. This idea that we imagine not only our own life worth living, but everyone involved, slowly. That we begin to care for those around us as much as we can, to understand that It's like choosing the lesser evil in the sense of that we know that we will have to cause harm and suffering in order to do what must be done. And so it's having empathy for that. It's having the wherewithal to see long term, to attempt to understand consequences, to understand that long term, the long path, there will have to be something other than what we're doing today. And to try to even begin the project of imagining that and how we might want move one foot in front of the other. But it also begins, how can we personally, right? How can we personally move through this? So a lot of us feel really stuck, right? We don't even feel ready to do this. We feel so stuck because of the captives, right? Because of our people being kidnapped and held as hostages, we feel like we can't move. We can't respond, some of us. So just to honor and acknowledge if you are there. So this empathetic imagination is for the other, but it's also for ourselves. And we try to even think, how could I be different about this thing? And I even practiced this today during Shabbat because I woke up, actually, even when I was lighting candles on Shabbat evening, I'm beginning to light the candles and do the bracha, the blessings on Shabbat, and I start sobbing because every time I go to light, I think of our people who are captives in Gaza who cannot light candles, who cannot say the bracha, the people who might be lighting on their behalf and thinking of them. And I always attempt to light on their behalf. For those who are just in so much pain of the direct loss of them, for those who actually can't still identify their dead and are wondering, are they dead or are they kidnapped? For those who finally know that their beloved one, a family member or friend, has been murdered, but there's nothing left of them. And so they have to, what is to put in the burial? What is to bury? They're For us, we have to be able, and this is what I did Friday night. I said, how can I be different about this thing? How can I bring a blessing to this, right? So of course, I always give tzedakah. We're always trying to give and support the effort, support the soldiers, support those who have survived this horrible genocide and the impact. Try to support those local who may be in need, who had to be displaced or moved. We have a whole Eritrean community up here in my kibbutz who needed to be moved out of Sedrot, somewhere to stay because of so many missiles coming in and bombing the area from Gaza, from the terrorists, Palestinian terrorists. So we have to be able to say to ourselves, how can I be different about this thing? And maybe for some of us, we're not ready to say that. We're not even ready to imagine. We can't. We're still stuck. And that's okay. Just acknowledge it. And also ask yourself when you're ready, maybe daily, maybe once a week before Shabbat, how can I be different about this? And the other thing that the experts in trauma and grief and loss share with us, in particular the work of Rick Hansen, he says certain things we don't recover from. Certain things we don't recover from. We cope. We learn to cope. There are coping mechanisms, but we don't recover. And so there are going to be some of us where that's the case. And even on a national level, it may feel that way for many years. Many. Where we, especially those closest to it, those who are closest to the people directly impacted, those who are Israeli, will definitely not feel recovery for a long time versus the Jews out in the diaspora, depending on what, of course, what happens worldwide over time. But we begin to recover more so, more quickly over the months and the years. So what we're looking for is, for some of us, there won't be a sense of equilibrium of well-being. We'll definitely be aware of that and practice toward it, but that's we can expect there won't be a sense of equilibrium of well-being for some time. And that this idea that the condition, what has happened, the condition will continue, right? And that's true for us from the Shoah, from the Holocaust. It's true from the pogroms in Europe and the Jews who were horribly treated and exiled from the Arab lands, from Africa. The Jews from Argentina, where Iran bombed a Jewish center in 19, was it 1993, 94, maybe 95. I'm trying to get my years. I was actually there. And then even going back further, right? All the treatment to us throughout Europe, hundreds of years. Obviously, the kidnapping of us from Rome and taking us out of our land of Israel, displacing us, putting us throughout Europe. So those conditions, this they even have a term for it that's called epigenic factors. Essentially, the suffering by our ancestors is in their DNA and gets passed on to us. It's here, right? It's with us. So part of the practice is that really asking ourselves, why do we live? Why do we choose life? We say, Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, the nation of Israel is alive and will live and God willing, thrive. So why? We have to individually find our own way. We have to look for quality, right? We have to look to be of service. We have to look and see this as a learning, as part of our spiritual practice, a part of our ongoing awakening over time. And so this is a big part of the coping and for some of us, recovery. It's really behavior activation, right? And there's a essentially really practicing and strengthening a core self of an ongoing sense of being, right? To care. So the final thing that's very important is this sense of focusing where we do have agency. Thank God we have our own country, our own borders, our own language, our own culture, our own living by our own calendar, all these beautiful and amazing things that strengthen us. We have our own army. And so we're able to respond and respond wisely and say, we are never going to let you do this to again. You are not a safe neighbor to have. There are consequences for your behavior. And this is it. We are going to go in and we are going to make sure that you cannot cause this harm and suffering again. And that is agency. And thank God for that agency. So we look for allies. We find meaning in our allies. And so this is a big part. And maybe there's a shift that we stop paying attention to who hates us as much. Of course, we want to be full, clear, seeing, right? That awakening of being really see things honestly and clearly. But our attention can be on who is cheering for us, who is praying for us, who is singing for us, who is sending people over to help us, who is showing up with their own ships and soldiers and advisement. Looking at who are our allies, even within the country. We might think this is only a Jewish thing, but we have plenty of Druze and Bedouin and Arabs who are with us and want Hamas gone and want to feel safe and thrive in the borders of the state of Israel. So this is very important. So with all this in mind, let's take a look together at our ancestors and how they move through things, okay? So just to remind you where we came before, Abraham and Sarah, they are together. They are they just obviously had their beloved son that they waited for many, many years. Unfortunately, Avraham attempts to sacrifice him based on the command of God, which we are told is a test of faith, a fear of God. Fear meaning yirah, meaning awe and fear. And all we hear from the Torah is when Avraham returns from attempting to do this sacrifice known as Akedat Yitzhak, that Sarah dies. Sarah is dead. Lots of our midrashim, our stories passed down from our ancestors, really address this and say that essentially she heard, found out what Avraham was doing, that she had that he had taken their only son without waking her, without asking for permission or consent, without discussing it with her, that he went and took him to sacrifice him, and she heard this. And she, it was just too much for her, right? Her heart gave out. She died. But there's a trauma right there. There's huge grief and loss. Huge grief and loss. And it reminds me actually, and I wish I had her name for her, I'm gonna look her up and I'll tell you next time. But there was a little girl, I'm thinking somewhere 8 to 10, maybe up to 12 here in Israel, who living with the rockets, the missiles coming over after October 7th, her heart gave out. She just couldn't take it anymore. She literally, I'm not sure if it was a heart attack or what it was. They tried to rush her to the hospital. She was rushing to a miklat, a safe room, to try to protect herself with the missiles coming. And her heart gave out. And it really reminded me this of Sarah. Like there's sometimes things that happen in our lives that are just too much for us, right? There's no coping. There's no recovery. It's just needing to be with Hashem. And so this is Sarah here. Sarah passes away, and Avraham is now facing, I am a total stranger in this land, total stranger. And as you know, in the ancient Middle East, it's really he's operating under what we would call a disability today, in the sense that it's of his status as an alien, okay? That he cannot avail himself of local burial facilities without permission, right? Essentially, permission for the whole am, municipal, right? He cannot acquire lands. You're not allowed to purchase and buy land if you were not among the people, part of them. And even if he were to overcome these restrictions, right, he still faces the problem of curing an inheritable state, that one that can actually be used for future generations. Because the people that are in control of the land at the time, they might let you have something temporarily, right? But they're not necessarily going to let you just like keep passing this land on to your children and grandchildren. That's unheard of, really. So, besides the legal problems, right? There really is a pervasive and deep-seated attitude throughout the ancient Near East that you don't part with your property. Property is not just seen as an object that you just get rid of and pass on. It's something where there's profound, not only emotional attachment, but a real understanding. It's a symbol, an object of continuity with one's ancestors and forebears. And it's a deep responsibility to one's family, clan, and posterity. So, posterity, excuse me. So, this is what he has to face. And he has to face it right with his dead lying before him. Sarah's dead, she's lying before him. And he's suddenly having to face this grief and loss. Right? And this is where he is. And he decides to cope, he pivots. He immediately engages in the obviously with the Hittites who own the land. He negotiates publicly with them before their gates and ends up buying the land from I believe it's Ephron for 400 shekels. Yes. And so that's where we see the first pivoting of despite having this grief and loss, we see someone that he is still able to address what needs to be done despite what's going on, right? And so this is where I want to bring the example of Abraham. So some of us are able to, despite the grief and loss, we're able to pivot. Like, think about all of our amazing soldiers, and specifically I'm thinking of the general speech right before they enter the land of Gaza. Like, these are people who are able to respond. They are our Abraham, right? So, and even like think of all the amazing brave people that during the actual genocide, while it's happening, driving back and forth, getting survivors, taking it with bullets flying into their cars. Or I'm thinking of the Nepalese people. There was a group of them inside of a safe room, and Hamas or Islamic Jihad, Palestinian terrorists, threw a grenade in, actually two of them, and one of the people picked up the grenade and threw it back. And then when the other grenade went off, he went and it was trying to help the other people in the room. These are people who are resourcing, who are responding, who not only are doing appropriate response, but that which is really trying to alleviate the harm and suffering of those around them to save people. It's quite amazing. Okay, so there's our Avraham. And then we get to his son, Yitzhak. Now you have to remember, Yitzhak was almost slaughtered. Whether he wanted to be part of the process or not, we don't know. Our Parshanim, our commentators, have many perspectives on this. But what we do know from the Torah exactly is a ram is substituted for him. He goes down a different way down the mountain. He doesn't go down with his father Abraham. They never speak again. Yitzhak has no mother to go home to when he returns. He ends up going to a completely different location. He ends up going to the location of Hagar, the very woman that Abraham had kicked out of the house with Ishmael. That's the location he went. We don't know if he went to her house or shared with her, but that's the area that he settles in, right? So that right away is like, how many red flags? Doesn't speak to his father anymore, doesn't get to speak to his mother anymore. Is essentially it, except in some key areas that we'll touch upon. So immediately, what one can feel that there's a deep grief and loss. What happened with his father, losing his mother, maybe even grief and loss, really understanding who he is, what's his purpose. He was supposed to be offered up for slaughter, for a sacrifice to Hashem, to God, and then he's replaced. Who is he? What is he? What is, what's he to do? There is a sense that there might be coping going on, right? So let's touch a bit upon this, okay? There's some other things that really lead us to think to this, right? He is alone of the patriarchs. There are three of them, right? There's Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. He alone of the patriarchs must never leave the land. He never leaves the land. He's homebody. He stays there, right? Not only that, later on, coming up in Toldot, the next Torah portion that we'll cover in chapter 26, verse 2, he's actually forbidden by God to leave the land even in a time of famine. So God too is trying to help him cope, help him maybe recover. But someone who, recognizes both God and him, that I'm someone that has to kind of stay put. I've had a little bit of trauma, grief, and loss. This is how I cope. This is how I deal with this, right? I'm not my father. I'm not moving around and negotiating, fighting wars, trying to save, a cousin or a nephew, Lot. I'm not heading down to Egypt during a famine. I'm not negotiating with the king, Abimelech. Like, there's not this, like, he's not his Abba. He's not his father. He's his own person, right? So he doesn't even leave in a famine. The only tikkun in the window I see here, what's quite beautiful about him, is that he's the only one who actually sowed the soil. We haven't seen this or heard this since Adam Rishon, where he's sent out of Garden Eden, he soils the soul. His son, right? We're talking about Cain and Hevel. Cain was supposed to do this, right? And Cain ends up being totally for the murder of the first murder recorded in the Torah, but he ends up being like exiled, and he's exiled so that he can't be a part of the land anymore. He's lost that privilege. He can't sow the soil. And here is Yitzhak doing this. So this one, I think, is part of his recovery, or definitely part of his coping. Okay. And he's very what we might see a little bit of I don't know if I would say it's passivity, but it's more just it's Avraham who arranges for a servant to bring a wife to him. He just accepts and receives her. He's really a mekubal, this someone who accepts what's going on. Okay, so let's keep him in mind because it's going to come up in Toldot later about how he's still coping and responding or reacting. We will see. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk about finally, quickly, before we move into our mindfulness meditation practice, a key figure that arises here that is going to really loom large in Toldot, and that is Rivka. Rivka is the sister of Lavan. That means that she essentially is she's related obviously to I'm losing my train of thought in the whole family drama here. There's a deep connection, a relationship to Avraham, and they're related to one another as family. And so she's aware, anyone would be aware that there's this person, there's Avraham, who has been told by God, Lech Lecha, get up and go, right? And she must have his story and idea in mind, right? So let's keep his who he is, right? So you can imagine this teenager, this young girl, being told about Avraham. And and probably the ancestors had some negative things to say about him. He left his people, he left his land. Not supposed to really do that. And but to the teenager, right, this might be someone who's pretty adventurous, pretty exciting, listen to this divine voice and leave. Trying to see things from her perspectives. So this is the Avraham that she might have heard about. Listen to these verbs that he is. This is him arguing on the behalf of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Talk about someone who knows how to resource. He runs, he prostrates, he hastens, he fetches, he carries, he stands, he serves, he draws near. This is when first and he's welcoming the angels and sees them coming, the three men in the desert. He's recovering from surgery, from a circumcision, and the high heat of the day. These are all, he is someone with zerizut, balanced enthusiasm. He goes and he serves and he does all this. He draws, and then the argument over Sodom. He draws near. What does he do? Despite knowing he's dust and ashes, he demands, he argues, he claims seven times, right? He musters all his inner resources. This really drawing near has three elements, as Rashi teaches this, what I touched upon last week, 2 weeks ago, that really it could be someone who's fighting, like joining a battle, someone who's appeasing, who's fawning, right? Someone who is praying, this real sense of freezing, right? In response to grief and loss, this real recoiling in awe. All this is happening. It's like talk about having great skill of pivoting. He is doing everything in response to what's being sent to him by God, what is being shared to him. And this is amazing because if you take a look, Rivka comes, here comes the servant. She doesn't know him. She's being essentially told, like her own Lech Lecha, like, it's time for you to get up. You're destined to join this family, right? God sent me. God told me that there would be this girl that would serve me and my camels and take care of me and invite me in. All these qualities. What does she do? She's amazing. When any other girl would be see him at the well, and then he might ask for some water, might be like, "You're standing at the well, help yourself." Does she do that? No. She says, "Oh, Hineni, I'm standing at the well." She goes and she does. Whereas any other girls might have, they're fetching water. They might say, "Why have you picked me? Like, I have a jug on my shoulder, right? Pick another girl who is still holding the water jug in her hand," right? This kind of passing off the responsibility to others, which is similar in our long heritage since Adam Rishon, the first Adam, right? We've seen this in Adam and Chava. We've seen this in Cain. We've even seen a little bit of Noah, right? This sense of I do what I really necessarily have to do, and then the rest I let go of. The sense of I'm not going to cause harm, right? The basic no, I'm not going to cause harm, but I'm not going to go out of my way and be responsible for you and take care of you. That's not Rivka. Rivka then tilts her jug, enables him to drink. She takes special effort to let down her brimful water jug in order for him to drink. And she's not annoyed. She's not impatient. And none of this is present, right? And she doesn't say to him, "Tilt the jar yourself from my shoulder and drink. Don't bother me to do it myself," right? She doesn't do that. This is what could have been done, right? And then finally, she offers to give his camels to drink, right? She has thoughtfulness and understanding, this capacity of kindness and compassion towards not only the servant, but also the animals, right? Maybe she even had that kind of empathetic imagination we talked about, thinking this man must be disabled on some level. He can't draw the water himself. He can't lower the jug himself. If he can't give drink to himself, he certainly is not up to watering his camels. That's what she did. She put herself in his shoes, right? She is our little Avraham, right? She's like a Avraham Ketana in the sense that, like, she is someone who runs and hastens and fetches and carries and stands and serves and draws near. This is it. This is amazing. This is like, and of course, his servant is like, "Oh, this is exactly what Yitzhak needs." Sure, if Yitzhak needs another Avraham in his life, but maybe in this form it's acceptable. Maybe it's more than acceptable. So this is what the servant sees. The servant thinks this is it. This is a divine sign from God. So look at Rivka. Why is Rivka able to move like this? She's had no, as far as we know, trauma or grief or loss happen to her. And what will happen to her when she heads down to go marry the man who's had so much grief and loss, who might still be coping, who might be in shock? When she sees him, she covers herself. And you might think, well, that was common for women who were meeting their future husband and to marry them. Maybe yes, maybe no. That's discussed among both the historians and our commentators. Maybe it's suggested that she covered herself because she really felt his trauma, his grief and loss, and it was too much to bear. So here's a teenage girl full of life and energy that's going into the tent of a 40-year-old man who hasn't moved, who can only remain still in the field, who doesn't leave the land even in famine, that she will go in and endure and try to cause life to happen. And that's where we'll head next in Toldot to really see how the continuing of recovery or coping happens. And may we continue to learn from our ancestors today. How many of us do we need to cover, take care of ourselves, that self-care when we see so much suffering from someone else, be able to lay healthy boundaries. I can honor your suffering, but I don't need to internalize it. I don't need to take it on, right? Some of us need to do that. Some of us need to be like Rivka. Some of us need to be like Yitzhak and stand still in the field to isolate, to be, recovering or coping. So we have the full range, and it's quite a blessing for us, this to be passed on to us. So I welcome you now, and a lot of teaching longer than usual to move into our practice together, our mindfulness meditation. So assume a posture that is both alert and awake and at ease. It can be seated, lying down, standing, or walking. And I invite you to close your eyes if you have vision and feel safe and comfortable. Otherwise, just lower your gaze so that you at least cut out some of the visual stimulation if you have that essentially. And we're going to begin with three deep cleansing breaths. Inhalation and exhalation. Inhalation, exhalation, and inhalation, this time raising your shoulders, and exhalation, letting it go. Really being present, inviting your full self here to this stillness, to this quiet, to this ease. Heart, mind, soul, body, the full body breathing. No need for you to control the breath, but just really being awake to my voice and your breath as it flows through you. And if the breath is too hard to pay attention to, you may pay attention to your thoughts, the sensations in your body, the sounds around you. Really just arriving, being kind to yourself, really saying quietly to yourself, may I be kind to myself. May I accept myself as I am. And this is a hard one for many of us right now. So it might feel disingenuous to say this right now to yourself, but go ahead and try it and sit with it. See, and notice if there's any reactivity. Notice whatever arises as part of your practice. May I accept life as it is. So what do you notice? Even ask yourself, can I be with this? I notice for myself a tightening of my stomach, even a contraction of the chest. And I know I can be with this. I invite kindness. I invite compassion towards myself. I even begin to rub my chest, which you're invited to do. I try to approach this with curiosity as I would if I was listening to my best friend who just told me she was trying to be kind to herself. She was trying to accept herself. She was trying to accept life as it is. Kindly say to yourself, may I be as safe as possible. May I be free from danger. May I be safe from inner and outer harm. May I be safe and protected from inner and outer danger and harm. Quietly whisper to yourself, may I live in safety. May I be free from fear. May I know safety and the causes of safety. May I be healed. May I be free from pain. We're directing this chesed, this metta, this loving kindness to ourselves, letting the body rest and the heart be as soft as possible. Breathing gently. Now we turn our love, our metta, our chesed to all those we love. To the captives, to those who've been kidnapped, being held hostage by the Palestinian terrorists. We're directing this to all our beloved children, spouses, aunts and uncles, cousins, friends who are serving in our army, attempting to rid us of this entity that causes us such harm and suffering and has. We direct to them, may you be safe from inner and outer harm. May you be well in body and mind. May you be free from danger. May you know safety. May you be free from fear. May you know safety and the causes of safety. May you be healed. May you be physically and mentally and emotionally strong and healthy. Allow these words to be a part of your heart as we direct them to those we love with our intention over and over again. And finally, in our most radical act of chesed, of loving kindness, if you are even have the capacity to turn now towards the Palestinians, turn now towards those who support the Palestinians and Hamas. Turn now towards those who support terror. And we say to them, may you be free of greed, hatred, and delusion. May you be free of greed, hatred, and delusion. May you accept responsibility. May you take responsibility. May you face the consequences of your actions. May you be free of greed, hatred, and delusion. May all this be held in loving kindness. May all this be held in chesed and metta. Connect to your feeling safe, protected, and loved. That you are taking here refuge and community here with me, with all of us here together, breathing the same rest. Yeah, really honoring your practice. Allowing the breath to remind you that this too shall pass, that everything changes, that everything is impermanent. Really sensing our vulnerability and knowing that we are in safe refuge. I am here with you and I care about you. You are here with me and you care about me. Bringing the threefold, inviting God to carry us, to be here with us, and to care about us, to help and hold and sustain all of us. When you are ready, you can gently and slowly open your eyes, coming out of this meditation, resourcing, coping, pivoting together, always in community, taking refuge. Today's teaching is in honor and memory of all those who served in the US military and in the Canadian military. Some of our greatest students and practitioners and followers come from North America. And we know that you honored Veterans Day and Canadian Remembrance Day on the 10th and 11th of this month when we were not able to meet to go over Chaye Sara. So this session is in your honor and memory. May everyone be really honored in the sense of everyone's memory be for a blessing that we continue to hold one another. I thank you for joining today's sitting and teaching. I look forward to connecting over Toldot soon. And you're welcome to be in touch with comments, questions, concerns. We welcome you to subscribe to our newsletter at kehilatmusar.com. To join the community, you're welcome to join as a member to support this public offering and the Institute and the work we do. And of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm Rabbi Chassia Uriel Steinbauer, the director, the founder of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. God bless you. Thank you.